So we're ready to go? Greetings and welcome, everyone. Yeah, I'm glad to see everybody here. This is, as you know, the first Virgin Flight of our Necessary Voices. And it's a collaboration of the entire English department. We're doing it not because we love putting up flyers and playing with microphones, but because we want to share with all of you the richness and the depth of a life immersed in the beauty of words, stories, writing, ideas. The humanities are under fire right now. I don't know if you know it, but it's true. Mostly from a group of short-sighted people who see the university as a place strictly to train our future radiologists and air traffic controllers. But we want everyone to remember, and we want to remind ourselves that the humanities and the big ideas of the humanities are central to our daily lives for all of us. And what better time for us to remind ourselves of this than this, the growing winter of our discontent, the tightening of the economic cinch. So why call it Necessary Voices? Well, I guess we could have called it This Is Your Brain on Literature. But no, like Kenneth Burke always says, and I always try to remind people, literature is the stuff that we think with. It's necessary. Besides Professor Lehman, who's going to be speaking today, later this semester, we're going to hear from a visiting professor who writes about the American tradition of nature writing and the literature that comes out of that. That's in October. And in November, the Poet Laureate of Connecticut, who is also an emeritus professor of University of Bridgeport, will be reading from his poetry. That's in November. And the spring begins with Professor Amy Naraki, who will be reading from her poetry. So keep an eye out for our posters, and please come again. So let me just tell you that I'm very, very happy to be introducing to you someone that most of you already know as the ultimate raconteur, our resident author of fiction, journalism, travel literature, and popular histories, most recently the Hamden book. Welcome with me, everybody, Professor Eric Lehman.
Thank you, Diane. Thanks, everybody. I'm honored to be the first one in this series, and I hope you guys enjoy my presentation. What I'm going to be talking about tonight is how we can use storytelling to get people interested in and to get them to connect with history. And I'm going to use my current book, the book that came out just a few months ago, Hamden Tales from the Sleeping Giant. I've also written a book on Bridgeport, and I'm writing one with my wife right now on the history of Connecticut wine. And in these books, what I'm trying to do is to get the local people interested in their local history, because I'm really committed to trying to sort of push back against the nomadic culture that we live in. When I was in my 20s, I liked to think of myself as a nomad, and I think a lot of people in America think of themselves that way. We move from town to town, from state to state, and never really think of one place as home. So I felt it really important to get that sense of home, and it's something that I worked for when I moved here to Connecticut, and something that I hope my writing is helping other people do. So, before I get into my new book, I want to talk about a little bit about my Bridgeport book and how I came to use this method of storytelling to get history across to people. When I was pitching this book to the Bridgeport book, this is Tales from the Park City, when I was pitching the book to the publisher, I said, what I'd like to do is tell the stories of people and then just kind of get the rest of the history woven into that. rather than telling the story of, like, this is the 1880s, then the 1890s, then the 1900s, the aughts, I guess. And so the publisher was a little weirded out by this whole situation. None of his other authors of local history had tried this before, and the most that they had done was to separate their book into like 100 different little anecdotes, each of which was a story. It's not a secret that this is a great way to tell history, but I wanted to try to weave the history into more cohesive stories centered around a few different people. I used P.T. Barnum. I used a number of other people. I pretty much stole documentary filmmaker Ken Burns' idea on how to tell a story of a person, and within that, weave the rest of the story. I don't know if anybody of you have seen his documentaries on baseball or jazz, or the national parks was the most recent. He uses the story of certain people, and then it works very well in film as a documentary. I tried to do the same thing with local history. So I'm going to take you through this book and talk to you about some of the challenges that you have trying to write history this way, and some of the benefits from having history presented to you in this way. So let's move right along here. This is a little quote from later on in the book, from the conclusion. Let me just read it out. One day you might stop at the ancient Jonathan Dickerman house to explore its modest rooms and primeval herb garden. Crossing the lane that Ezra Day rode to teach Sunday school, you could reflect on the longer path he took to glory and doom. A trail leads along the banks of the Mill River, past the crumbling stone foundation of the axle shop, and to the site of Munson's ancient dam, where a fly fisherman, the ghost of A.C. Gilbert, perhaps, hooks a trout. Taking a fork in the path, you ascend through glacial wreckage to the lip of an old quarry. Below, arches and pillars of a ruin shimmer through the leaves. History itself seems to catch the corner of your eye. So, this is coming in the conclusion. The people that I'm writing to know all these people now. Know Jonathan Dickerman, know Ezra Day, know A.C. Gilbert. Okay, they know what the axle shop is because I've already told them, and I'm bringing it around to them. I'm not a historian like Professor Julius Berger is. I'm a travel writer, or at least that's how I like to think of myself. And so I'm trying to bring a little of the travel writing here to a local place. Everyone from Hamden who reads this is going to know these places and know them better, hopefully because of my book, and hopefully connect with them. I'm looking at you, Tim and Steve. They're from Hamden. Okay. So one of the challenges to writing a local history is, and making it interesting to people, is what to focus on and what to how to shape the history around themes. Some people say you shouldn't do that. You should. Maybe Professor Julius Berger will yell at me after a class after this about this. But some people think that you shouldn't shape things around themes, that you should really just present the history as it was. But the history is as it was, and the challenge is to make it appeal to people, to get them interested in. Maybe they'll go and look at the primary documents after reading my book. So one of the things I found about Hamden was that it was a landscape of the imagination, I like to say. The people who came to Hamden were inspired by it, and it inspired things like this is the ghost parking lot. Has anyone ever seen this? Does anyone remember seeing this? Tim remembers, but anyone ever see a picture of it? Maybe the design students or anything? It was in hundreds of art books. It was the first site-specific art installation like this in the United States. You can see what they've done here. They've buried a number of cars in the parking lot and cover them over with asphalt. Looks like a ghost parking lot. This was right off the exit at the Hamden Plaza in Hamden. that, which was actually the first one of the first outdoor malls in the United States. You know, those strip malls. It's one of the first ones. But this was something that would seem weird in other towns, a huge outdoor arts installation like this. But in Hamden, it wasn't weird at all. So that's the kind of thing that I was getting across. Is of course appeal to me because I'm a writer and I like to think that I have an imagination. So I was hoping to connect with that. I did find a number of writers and artists who lived in Hamden. Henry Austin is an architect. His name's mostly forgotten today, but he did do many of the buildings in New Haven. And pretty much, if you go to Yale and see that sort of Gothic look that Yale has, he started that with his Dwight Hall, which was the library at the time. William Linton was a famous, I didn't know how to describe him. He was a writer, a printer, a poet. He was he was involved in politics. He was friends with all the political radicals of Europe. Really fascinating guy. He was also, he came to America. He was from England, and he came to America and settled in Hamden, and was friends with people like Walt Whitman and Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and all these other people. He did the first, my wife probably likes this, but he did the first collection of American poetry, the first good collection. It was the first one also to include the songs of the slaves in it. He put that together. Alice Washburn was one of the first female architects in the United States. At that time, I think it was like 0.2% of architects were women in the 1920s when she was an architect, and she built some amazing houses. She had already been a school teacher and a high school principal, and then decided, I guess as a retirement project or something, she was going to build houses. And she built the most beautiful houses, some of which are in New Haven and Cheshire, most of which are in Hamden. And really fascinating character. This is not Chauncey Ives. This is a statue by him, which you can see in the Barnum Museum when it reopens. And actually, I just saw another copy of it in, where was that, Amy? The Brooklyn Museum of Art. Yes, and so he was a famous sculptor at the time in the late 19th century. He's got stuff in the Met in New York, everything. So these were some of the people that I decided to frame, or I guess you could call it frame, to take my narrative through the book. In the Alice Washburn chapter, of course, I'm talking about her architecture and how she shaped the town of Hamden, but I'm also talking about the other ways the town was shaped and the other buildings that were going up and how pretty much a rural community was changing into a suburban community that we know of it as it as today. I also, of course, found a lot of business people that I could write about. A.C. Gilbert. You might know A.C. Gilbert. He was the kids don't know A.C. Gilbert today because his toys aren't around anymore. But he had the Erector set. Does anybody know the Erector set? And he started. He was the first one to make kids chemistry sets and things like that. Did anyone have a chemistry set growing up or anything? He started that. He started the idea of toys for children that were a little advanced like that, right? A chemistry set. You know, before that, people were like, I'm not giving my kid his chemistry set, right? He's going to blow something up. So, but he thought that was a good idea, that that's what would inspire the next generation. He's known as the man who saved Christmas, because during World War I, he convinced Congress and the government to not close the toy factories. They wanted to turn the toy factories into war factories, right? And so he convinced them not to do that. That would be a big mistake. And he did it famously by bringing a bunch of his toys down to Congress and putting them all out on the table, and by the end of the meeting they were all playing with the toys. And so, yeah, so James Ives is not known outside of Hamden, but I found that a local figure who affected the landscape of the town was also really important to focus on. Some of these other people are well known. Someone like A.C. Gilbert, there's an A.C. Gilbert Society right now. There's no society to James Ives, but he did affect the town itself, and of course that's what I'm writing about, so I again focused on him.